Hi there, I'm Viv Joynes, and welcome to episode 6 of the Live Beyond podcast, where I speak to people that essentially inspire me, people who step outside of their comfort zone and achieve some pretty amazing things. So hopefully that'll inspire you too to maybe try something that you've been scared of, been meaning to do for a while, and maybe just get out there and go for it. In this episode, I speak to a chap called Leo Tong, who was introduced to me by a friend of mine. He has a pretty interesting and cool approach to life, as you'll hear. I certainly left the conversation feeling that I could try and achieve anything, which is a pretty awesome feeling to have. We chat about his upbringing in Australia, his time in London, where he worked in the music industry and the sporting industry, but also some pretty crazy cycling adventures, which culminated last year in him completing the Transcontinental Cycle Race. Now, it's quite a new race, not everyone will know what it is, but as a very brief synopsis, he covered 4,400 kilometres in 19 days, and over that time, probably climbed about 40,000 metres. So not for the faint-hearted. I really enjoyed my conversation with Leo. I really hope you do too. I suppose, just as a point to add, it's the first episode that I've recorded on Skype, so I hope it's all right, and happy listening. Hi there. So today I'm joined by Leo Tong. Hi, Leo. Thanks very much for joining.
Hello.
So Leo is by day a creative technologist, but in his spare time engages in some pretty cool adventures, and last year completed the Transcontinental Cycle Race, which is a pretty tough and grueling race, which we'll come on to later. But I'm going to start with something that I read that Leo had written, and that was that, and I quite liked it. He said he had a healthy disrespect for the impossible. And from what I can tell, this seems to apply quite nicely to his sporting endeavours, and also professional life to an extent. So I just wondered sort of where that approach came from, whether it was something that you've always had, you've always been into the outdoors, into adventure, whether your parents were like that, or whether it's just something that's kind of grown over time.
I think that I've come, I guess, to believe that because I don't have a massive sporting background. My parents weren't massively sporty, but I did grow up in Australia, in Queensland, and Australia is a sporting nation, so you are encouraged to take up sport all through school, and the weather is totally conducive for getting involved in all those sorts of activities. And I was never really good at it when I was young. But in high school, I became quite good at athletics. And I don't know, I do kind of know why, but it's embarrassing to say.
I won't push you.
I was kind of bullied a bit when I was younger.
Okay.
And I was often chased, and nothing really serious, but the fact that I was running around a lot, I guess, made me quite quick. And then I applied that to sport, and then in the end I was the athletics champion in my school.
Wow. And I suppose that had its own repercussions in terms of not being the kid that was bullied.
I don't remember so much about that, but I do remember that it was an interesting turn of events that I was suddenly good at something which I never thought I was. Because when I was much younger, I was always the kid that was picked last in picking teams, and they'd stick me in the relays, which is the losers' event generally, or something like that. So I would never be particularly, good at sport when I was younger grades, but as I went through high school, I became better and better, and only at athletics. But I also played rugby as well, and I was all right at that.
And in athletics, what did you specialise in?
I didn't specialise anything because you became champion by being kind of good at everything, and so I was never. I guess that's what I'm like. I'm not an expert at any particular thing, or I don't specialize in one particular area. But I was good enough at like a heptathlon, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Good enough at a lot of different events, like sprinting, everything except long distance. I sucked at long distance. Anything over 400 meters, I was terrible at. But I really enjoyed the field events like triple jump, high jump, discus, javelin. Even though I wasn't amazing at them, I was pretty good, I guess, because I suppose I had to be. But
I know obviously athletics is largely an individual sport, but were you competing for your high school, and that becomes more of a sort of team as opposed to individual, or did it always kind of feel like it was an individual pursuit?
For me, it was an individual thing. You did have a house. Everyone had a denominational school, and everyone had I don't know what you call it here, but everyone had their own sort of house, which everyone belonged to. And so there would be, in our school, I think we had 7 houses or something, and you'd be, I guess, like an alma mater, but in a school context.
Yeah, I think it does exist. And the UK, I think some schools have house system. So all the different year groups kind of split out. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, everybody, I can't even remember what the name of the house I was in. So
so not that much attachment.
No, no. Interesting.
Obviously, like running and all of that, when did cycling come into the picture? And also what I find interesting is you said you were doing short distances, and we'll come on to it later, but obviously now you're doing huge endurance, not necessarily running, but nevertheless pretty, which is obviously quite a big change. But yeah, when did the cycling come into the picture?
I've always cycled since I was a kid. Nothing competitive, though. I think I did a little bit of BMX, but nothing massively competitive. I used to cycle to commute and to school and to work, and it was a way to, I guess, save money. It was fun. I'd go just ride around and do stupid things and whatever. But I never took it up as a particular sport besides a bit of recreational mountain biking occasionally. And so I never had a road bike until I got to London. So I've been in London for the past 11 years.
Okay.
So I moved in 2004 from Australia to London. And it was a really cheap way to get around, as I'm sure you know, that London public transport is not very fun, and it's expensive.
Yes, it is.
So cycling, or just commuting around, was a way to just explore practically it was very useful.
Yeah, it is. I think cycling. I love that. Either cycling or running or walking, you just see things in a different way. Because when you're on the underground or the tube, you end up sort of you don't even know where you are half the time. So why did you move to the UK in the first place?
For music, I was really interested in music, and I've always been brought up, not deliberately, but I guess I've grown up around a lot of inspirational people and friends who in different, who have different interests and in different worlds, and most of my friends who were young, when I was young, were older than me, so they were in their 30s and 40s when I was still a teenager. So I'd often hang around with them and learn about all these really interesting subcultures.
Like what?
I don't know, heavy metal. Dance music, DJing.
Right, okay.
A lot of it was music. Where I'm from, it is. I found that it's a great place to grow up and probably to retire, but to. I didn't find personally there was much opportunity for me there because I was really interested in different cultures.
Hmm.
I guess because of this upbringing where I just made lots of friends in different who were interested in different things. So I learned about these different cultures where there was nothing available or supportive of it where I was from. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah, absolutely.
And London was very appealing because one, I wanted to go traveling and backpacking and whatnot, but London felt at the time was like a center of music, the music world, and I really wanted to get in it. So yeah, I kind of secretly wanted to just get involved in that, but also go backpacking. But when I got here, when I got to London, I ended up just diving straight into the music thing, I suppose.
Oh, cool. In what way? In sort of... Oh, yeah, because you... Did you start your own company?
So,
events company, or is that...
Yeah, when I arrived, I met some people... kind of by chance. It's a long story, but I met some really cool people and I wanted to, they were running like a club night, I guess, and I wanted to get involved and do that as well. And so we got together and built on that, and we created something pretty special and pretty big. And
so what kind of was it club nights?
Yeah, like sort of like dance music.
Yeah.
So we did nights at some great clubs which no longer exist, unfortunately.
And so I guess I don't know. I mean, was it just at the time, was it just sort of a series of events that led to you starting your own business, or was it, and did it feel scary at the time, or did it just feel like a sort of natural course of events?
Well, that was I guess it was more of a side project because I did have a day job.
Right.
I was working in retail and working in, and then I got a job in the music industry, working for a digital music company, That moved on to working at Ministry of Sound to run their digital music division.
Amazing.
Not on my own, obviously, but that was cool. And then I worked at Juno Records, which is another music business in London. And then
so you really managed to combine sort of passion with professional work.
I guess so. And coming back to what you were saying about having a healthy disrespect for the impossible, is that I never thought I could do a lot of these things, and when I happened to just make them happen somehow, I never really thought anything was impossible, I guess.
That's really nice. And so actually you were proactively focusing on specific goals then to try and make them happen.
I guess so. Yes and no. Some of it was as I was steered towards because I was in need of a visa, essentially, and I had to take a particular type of job with my expertise, or you know, my skills, I guess, not my expertise, but and so I was the field was narrowed to what I could do, and I was. Yeah, I love music, so I guess I did that, and I'm not sure. It's been a long time since I've thought about this, but or I haven't talked about it, so it's all coming to me now, I guess.
Yeah, and so that, do you think that achieving things that you didn't necessarily think you could achieve in your professional life, is that what's sort of driven the cycling part of things as well?
Partly, and also in my personal life, just there were lots of small situations where people would say, "Oh, you can't do that. That's not the way you can, you know, you do things." Or
yes, I know the feeling.
I always, I guess, felt that if someone told me that you couldn't do something that way, I thought, "Oh, yes, you can. There's always a way around it." one of the things that happened to me was that in that time, I was me and my partner at the time, we were denied entry into the UK. We were stuck in Belgium, and they literally refused us entry.
Wow.
at the border on that side, and they said, "Sorry, you're not coming in. We believe you to be trying to overstay your visa," or something like that. And it was a complete mistake. And they said, "Sorry, you'll have to go back to Australia."
Wow.
And you know, I said, "Well, all our stuff and our life is in the UK. What are we going to do?" And they said, this is the border agency, and they said, "Well, I'm sure you've got friends there. They can send it back for you."
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so we were stuck in Brussels, and the British embassy couldn't help us, because they can only help British citizens.
Right.
And only the British embassy in Australia could help us. So we would have had to go back to Australia to I guess, try and deal with this or whatever. And then basically I said, I'm not taking no for an answer. I'm going to fix this. I'm going to make it happen. So we were stuck there for about 10 days and lots of calls and letters and I guess knocking on doors, essentially, trying to take it to the, you know, trying to see someone that people don't let you see. So we went to the British Embassy and the staff there said, "I'm sorry, we can't help you." And then I said, "Well, I'd like to speak to your supervisor, or I'd like to speak to the consul of the embassy." And they said, "Oh, well, you can have an appointment. We can try and set you up with an appointment with the consul, but I can guarantee you they're going to tell you the same thing I'm telling you. And I'm just warning you, so you're not disappointed." I said, "That's fine. I've always believed that as long as I can, if I have a face-to-face meeting with someone,
mm-hmm.
I can... I suppose not be persuasive, but have that human interaction where someone will understand and people always have discussion."
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And they always have a compassionate side to them if they don't seem to on the surface.
Mm.
So I made sure that this appointment was going to happen, and then. Yeah, had a meeting with the consul, and they looked at the situation and said, I'm very sorry, this is clearly a mistake. I'll fix this immediately and we'll get you a visa back in to the UK, and then you can sort out the rest of it when you're there." So yeah, that was one of the biggest things when someone said when people were telling me that this is impossible, you can't do this, and even the law pretty much says once you've refused or something, there's no right of appeal in this situation. And I just didn't believe it, and I didn't feel that that was the way I was going to deal with it. So most of my approaches since then have been similar, I guess.
It's funny, isn't it, how an event like that can really change your approach to how you do things.
Mm.
And yeah, as you said, like, it makes you realise that yeah, when you're told no, it doesn't always mean no.
Yeah.
And find ways around.
Exactly.
So coming back to, there's the music going on, and that sounds really interesting. And then you said that you were using cycling to commute largely and sort of get around London.
I was commuting for cycling. I was cycling to commute, and there was this other. I wanted to get involved in more of a cycling community because I saw these groups of people riding around. I thought, oh, that looks pretty fun. I thought, how can I sort of get involved in that? Or, you know, it was like a fixed gear scene, I guess. And there's a forum, a big forum, which has a lot of fixed gear riders, and it's a pretty good forum. And I wanted to, I guess, I like to challenge myself into these silly little challenges. And one of them was, I'm really interested in subcultures, and I really wanted to, I guess, be accepted by this subculture, even though I'm a complete outsider. And I like to do this in lots of different fields and worlds, and just because I'm interested in them. And it's hard to learn a lot from something when you're not part of the community, I guess. Okay. You learn a lot more when you're part of that community.
Yeah.
I suppose. And so I wanted to gain acceptance as a challenge, I guess.
Okay.
Because I wanted to learn more, and there were some really interesting people there. And so I think what I did was I thought, oh, I know how to... Oh, I'll do this. I'll just ride a Boris bike 200 kilometres or something. And
I saw that. I read an article about you doing that.
Okay. that was the first week that they first came out in London, those hire bikes. I literally pulled one off the peg, and there's this event called the Dunwich Dynamo, which is a night ride from London to Suffolk, and
which is on the coast, isn't it?
Yeah, the Suffolk coast. Yeah. And I've never done this ride before. I can't remember. I don't know if I did. Maybe I did, but I hadn't done anything like this. And
can you just explain what a Boris bike is?
Okay, Boris bike is one of the municipal hire bike scheme bikes that various cities around the world provide. London have these really heavy bikes, and they weigh 23 or 25 kilograms.
Mm-hmm.
So they're supposedly theft-proof, but I've seen many people riding around with painted over numbers and whatnot.
Oh, really? Amazing.
Yeah, it's quite fun.
And they don't, presumably, do they have gears?
They do. They have very low gears, so they're very spinny.
Okay.
You can't really pedal more than... I don't know. I think the fastest I've been on one is about 40 kilometres an hour downhill.
Oh, downhill. Okay, I was going to say.
Downhill. But I also did a race on one. The first official Boris bike race.
Wow.
I didn't win. I came second, but
that's pretty good.
Yeah, should have won though.
How long was the race? How far was it?
It was. Have you heard of an event called the London Nocturne?
Oh, I think I have actually.
It's a circuit race around Smithfield Market.
Oh, okay, no, I haven't. I thought it was something else.
It's an annual event, and they have professional teams come and race there as well. So there's
amazing.
About, yeah, so you know, Team Sky will come down and race that, and.
What time of year is that?
It's in the summer.
Okay.
So it's a nighttime race, so the events will start in the afternoon about 4 p.m. I think, and then they'll have various races. I'll have a folding bike race where they'll have promptons and whatnot. They'll have a penny farthing race.
Oh, fantastic.
They'll have women's races, some amateur team races, some amateur races, and then the professionals, so professional men and women,
okay,
or the elite men and women race. And
okay,
so it's a great event. It finishes about 10 p.m. at night, so it's hence why it's called the Nocturne, because it's a race in the dark.
Yeah. So you decided to ride this Dunwich Dynamo. It's 120 miles, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, 120 miles.
And it's sort of unorganised, isn't it? People just kind of pitch up
You just rock up and you just ride.
Yeah. That was to gain access to this subculture, really, part of the motivation?
That was a very minor thing, actually. I don't think I thought about that until afterwards. But I wanted to do it because it looked silly and fun, and I don't take too many things that seriously, even racing, or I guess the transcontinental. I don't know how seriously I took that.
So why did you do it? Is it just because it's something that you don't know whether you can do, or
why not? Because you can. Because no one's done it, and I thought, I'll do that. That'll do.
Brilliant. How did it go?
It was hard. It was hard, but it was actually really enjoyable because I got a bit of a head start. I left a bit earlier than everyone else because I knew that I couldn't cycle as fast as everyone. So I popped a radio in the front basket and just went on my own and had about an hour head start from everyone and just... You know, you ride through the night, so you ride through the countryside and there's hardly any cars around.
Right, okay.
And all you can hear is the whir of freewheels and people spinning their pedals. And then a trail of red lights riding through the night. And, yeah, everyone's very friendly and saying hello. And
I was going to say, this is quite nice. I've got quite a few friends who've done it, and it sounds like there's very nice camaraderie.
It's a really good atmosphere, yeah. I'd recommend everyone should just try it once. And it's just really fun. You learn a lot, and the weather's usually pretty good, and all sorts of people do it. I've seen people do it. I've seen kids do it. I've seen eight years old.
Wow.
And I've seen grannies do it, who were probably in the 80s.
Amazing.
Seeing people in tandems do it, people on Bromptons do it. I've seen the one guy who outdid everyone. I've seen it was a few years ago. He did it on a BMX, and that means you can't. There's no sitting down. He didn't sit down for 200 kilometers.
Oh my goodness, that's totally crazy.
Yeah, it was that guy. Deserved a few beers after that because the bikes are really spinny in the first place. So they're probably even more spinny than a Boris bike.
Yeah, exactly. True. Yeah. And so was that when you started getting more into cycling and where there was more of community involvement?
That was one of the things. So I got amongst this community and I learned a lot about the world of, bikes and gear and all that sort of stuff. It was just fascinating to know about it. And then there was this brand that everyone loved to hate on, and that was called Rafa. And I'd never heard of Rafa. And there's this whole thread, and it's still, I think it's still the biggest thread on this forum. It's probably 10, 12 years old now or something. Yeah. It must be 10 years old at least. And people are still posting every single day on this forum about Rafa, and that's a testament to how divisive and interesting this brand is.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that. I didn't realise there was hating on Rafa.
Really?
Yes, really. But that shows my ignorance slightly in relation to the cycling community.
So I wanted to know what all the fuss was about.
Yeah.
I went into this Rafa pop-up in London. It was in Clerkenwell at the time. And I'd never been to road cycling before that. I didn't really know much about it at all, actually. I would say I had zero knowledge of the sport.
Okay. And this was... I think you did the Dunwich Dynamo. Was that 2011-ish?
The Dunwich Dynamo, I think so. It was a, I don't really remember.
So
I
all
think
of this was, yeah.
Yeah, maybe then. But they, I guess they're kind of unrelated. Maybe they are related.
Okay.
But I went into this store and I thought, oh, I really like this. This is I don't really like, in general, I don't really like fashion as a concept, I guess, I'm not that fashionable, but it's not a fashion brand specifically, and in general, I don't like the way brands market to people. I think it's really poorly done, but I really appreciated that what Raffle was doing. I thought that this was really, really nice and really considered, and really, they really cared about what they were doing.
Okay.
You know? Yeah, it wasn't just, it's a temporary campaign for marketing, and then they'll just move on to the next thing they think of, which might be completely irrelevant to what they believe in or what they're trying to sell.
Just for people who don't know what Rafa is, am I right in saying that Rafa is the Sky Teams kit?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
So Rafa supply the... I guess, yeah, the Team Sky with their on an off-bike kit.
Yeah, okay.
And so they're a cycling brand.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just make clothing, they also run events. They have a travel business, and then they sell clothing.
Okay.
But they also support grassroots cycling. They have... they've just... started sponsoring a women's team, so supplying all their on and off bike kit,
mm-hmm.
straight for women's sports, and so a really great brand, and I don't think we talked about this, but I basically started working there.
Okay.
And so after walking into this shop, I thought, I want to work here.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose going on what you were saying about a disrespect for the impossible, how would I have a chance of working here? Because, you know, I've no experience in cycling. I don't know anything about road cycling. I don't know fashion. I don't know anything about cycling kits.
Mm-hmm.
What place do I have here? But I want to work here, right? So I'm going to work.
Okay.
I'm going to work here. So what I did was essentially I thought of all the ways that what I could offer to this company, what could I offer this company that they don't know that they need.
Mm-hmm.
So I essentially pitched my skills, and I offered to solve particular problems that the company, I thought the company had.
Okay.
I didn't know if they agreed with that, but I thought, okay, how am I going to do this? I will, I'm going to find the guy who's responsible for this sort of decision, and I'm going to meet him. I'll run into him somehow.
Right.
And I will pick his brains, and I'll pester him, and I'll propose to him. I'll propose what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And so a mutual friend said that there's this event that he's going to be at. Why don't you come down? And I'll introduce you if you want. And I said, oh, cool, that sounds great. So I did that, and then we had a chat. I said how I could help them. And at the time, it was in social media. And because I was interested in that. I had no experience in social media, professionally.
Okay, right.
But I get it. I know how to use it. I understand how it works. I understand the technical aspects, the cultural aspects of it. And I could improve things in that area for this brand and drive it forward and help it to achieve a lot of things that I guess that they didn't really expect or feel that they could with using social media.
Mm-hmm.
So I proposed a number of things, and then the marketing manager at the time said, "Okay, cool. Well, just that sounds really interesting. Why don't you send me a piece of paper or a proposal, and I'll have a look, and maybe we can chat sometime." I said, "Okay, cool." So I did that. I didn't hear anything for 6 months, and then I got a call. Literally, as I was being made redundant from my old job.
No way.
Would you like to come and have a chat? I said, yes, absolutely, that sounds great. So I did, and they they didn't actually offer me a job at the time. I had to ask, are you actually offering me a job? And then they looked at each other and said, oh, I suppose so. So this was after a few meetings, and they were even willing to sponsor me to stay in the country.
Super.
So I headed up their social media for 3 years and other sort of marketing areas and
learned a lot more about cycling, presumably.
Yeah, some other sort of technology areas and design things and lots of little things, and learned loads about cycling, and that was my indoctrination into the world of cycling.
Amazing. I think it's so interesting what you say, because I think in life, there's always reasons you can't do things. Mm. And I think, there's various external limitations that we all face, but I think the majority of the time we kind of put them on ourselves. So,
exactly.
I don't know. Yeah,
it's
just sort of fear of failure, exactly. Overanalyzing, all this kind of stuff. But you seem to not, you seem to be able to get rid of all of that and just focus on the goal.
I still do that.
Really?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
It would be, I'd be completely naive if I didn't have some sort of fear of failure or overanalysis. I do that all the time, but I have to remind myself that things are not always as they seem, everything's okay, and you should just, you generally have nothing to lose to try and do something.
That's really interesting. And so in terms of the challenge aspect then, so obviously you did this Dunwich Dynamo, between that and I suppose doing the Transcontinental, were there lots of other things in between? And I think you joined, or you're part of a cycling team as well called Fifth Floor.
Yeah, so the Fifth Floor, I think that sort of came about by chance as well. I met the guy who started that team. It was more of a small club. It's just a group of mates who just like riding bikes.
Okay.
So it's never been a serious thing. And that was the great thing about it. They become some of my best friends, and I met this guy Rudy at an event, and we just got chatting, and then one day he said, do you want to join us? And I said, yes, why not? I'm not a serious cyclist, or I don't really race or anything like that, I just want to warn you that if you're expecting results or any level of seriousness, I don't know if I'm the right person. And he said, no, that's cool. We just hang out, man. We just ride and we just chat and whatever. There's no pressure to do anything like that. And that was the great thing. So it is a team. It is a racing team now, more so. But everyone has their own disciplines, what they're particularly interested in,
mm-hmm.
or what they're really good at, and everyone just does their own thing. We all went for a group. I'm not in it anymore because I've moved. But everyone does their own thing. Everyone's it's just a group of mates. So there's no particular agenda besides riding your bikes and having fun. I guess that's
and
it.
And eating pizza by the looks of things.
And eating pizza, that is the
very important. But I think it's really interesting what you say also about these subcultures and communities, because I suppose, I don't know, if we take, traditionally, when people moved around or moved to different countries and things, I guess maybe religion or other aspects played a big role in terms of mm-hmm. people fitting into new communities. And
yeah.
these subcultures, I think, I don't know whether they replace in some aspects, but they definitely provide that community whereby in running there's the same thing. There's these urban running crews that exist mm. all over the world. And so, yeah. you know, if I decide to move to Hong Kong or New York, mm-hmm. I've got a group that I can just slip yeah, myself
exactly.
into.
Exactly.
And you've kind of got your community and family around you. And it sounds like it's the same, you know, with the music subculture that you were talking about earlier and also mm-hmm. with cycling.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think absolutely. That's kind of cool. And because where are you? You said you move. Where are you living now?
So I'm currently in Spain, and my partner and I are moving to Kenya in a few weeks' time.
Wow.
Just because we, part of the decision to do the transcontinental, or part of that sort of decision process involved wanting to go traveling mm-hmm. and. Part of that meant that we had to quit our jobs or do something like that. So I knew that I had to take the transcontinental quite seriously, whereas previously I would have just gone, I'll just rock up and do it and whatever. But I realized what a big sort of thing undertaking it was. So I thought, okay, I don't have much time to train this sort of, to do this sort of distance and, at this level, so maybe I should quit my job, and I'll use that as an excuse to for us to both leave and start our travels, I guess.
Because
okay. we're quite fortunate in a way that we don't have any serious commitments in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
We don't own a house, we don't have any pets or kids or or own. Anything
yeah.
big and hard to move. So we're quite mobile, which is great. And we thought, let's just do it while we're still able to. And
Okay, amazing. So definitely yeah. adventures to come. So let's talk about the transcontinental. That was last summer, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to just, because I think, I'm not sure everybody would know what it is, because it's only, I think last year was the third year that it was on, if
That's
I'm not
right.
mistaken.
Yeah.
So do you mind just explaining what the idea is?
Okay, so the Transcontinental is a race across Europe from, it changes every year, but for the past couple of years, it's been from Belgium to Turkey, starting in Flanders and finishing in Istanbul last year. And essentially, it's an unsupported race. And all you have to do is get to the four checkpoints along the route, along the way, but mm-hmm. you can choose any route you want to these four, between these four checkpoints and the finish and start, obviously. So it's completely self-sufficient. There's no support whatsoever. Basically, no one will come to your aid unless you're in a serious accident, essentially.
Okay.
And basically you're on your own and you have to sort out your own sleeping arrangements, your own food, your own, I'm just trying to compare it to a general sportive type event, I
yeah.
guess, that you have to navigate everything yourself. There's no route. So you have to plan your own route. There's months and months of planning generally just to, work out what you're going to do, how you're going to do it. And the
idea of it's quite interesting, I think, because I just read the website, and I think the guys or the people that put this together mm-hmm. were sort of like initially when before cycling became sort of a big commercial sport, mm-hmm. that's what races sort of were. It was
yeah.
kind of crazy people that went off totally unsupported
mm-hmm.
And did crazy distances.
Yeah.
And then obviously it became very commercial, and that's brilliant in itself because it promotes the sport and mm-hmm. and all of that. But that they wanted to create this event that recreated what cycling used to be like.
Exactly. It's not really a spectator event. Although there are thousands of spectators that watch it online, but not through video feeds. They just watch tiny dots moving around a map.
Yeah.
So everyone has a live tracker. And this is for safety reasons,
mm-hmm.
Just to make sure that everyone's still alive, essentially. and keep so that they ensure that they keep moving.
So what's the time? Because you have to get to each checkpoint by a specific time, don't you? And how much time do you have to cover the whole?
You don't have. There's no time limit. There's no time limit.
Oh, okay.
It's meant to be an accessible event, an accessible race that anyone should be able to do.
And
you don't need a fancy bike, only if you want one. You don't need to get sponsorship. You don't need a support crew because you're not allowed one.
Yeah.
You're not allowed help, essentially. You can't solicit help. If someone offers you help, there's a gray area where you can and can't accept it. But essentially you can accept help that is available to everyone else. So I could go to a shop and buy stuff. Or I could go to a hotel and stay in a hotel if I wanted to, or if someone on the side of the road offered me something, I could accept it because they could offer it to someone else mm-hmm. as well. I don't specifically know this person.
Yeah.
But if someone one of my friends had a house along the way, I wouldn't be able to stay there.
Oh right, okay.
If a friend of mine or someone I knew had a bike shop and they offered to stay open a bit later for me, that wouldn't be allowed either unless they offered that to everyone.
Okay, and so I saw on the different sort of finishing times on the website, people get penalty time. Is that why?
So no, there are penalty times for various reasons, but mainly because there are particular stretches of road which are forbidden for riding on.
You're not allowed to ride
these roads because they have no cycling signs on them, and they're usually big tunnels or something like that.
Right. Okay.
Or they're fast moving dual carriageway type roads where there's a bike or a quieter route parallel to that. So if you are caught using these illegal roads, essentially, then you will be penalised with a time penalty.
Okay. So I think the other thing about this race, so I'll just give a couple of stats mm-hmm. in terms of what Leo achieved, because it is pretty phenomenal. I think last year... I think there were 172 riders that started and only 89 yes. completed.
I think so, yeah.
So hats off for finishing.
Thanks.
And also, so covered 4,400 kilometres, correct me if I'm wrong,
that's
in 19 days, 2 hours and 40 minutes,
yep.
which I think that's an average of 230K a day.
Yes.
Which is
quite
a long way.
But... It was really hard. It's the hardest thing I've ever done, and I wouldn't wish it upon anyone to try and do. But if someone wants to do it, I will totally encourage them.
Fair enough. I see what you mean. I went through your Instagram posts during it, and it's really interesting to follow the journey, because it was a pretty difficult year. I mean, presumably it's always difficult in terms of the elevation, because I think you climb over that 4,400 kilometre, you climb 40,000 metres or something. There's a hell of a lot of climbing. So I guess that makes it tough. But the weather didn't look great this year in terms of pretty terrible at the beginning, rain, miserable weather, and then just boiling hot, sort of 35 degrees. Towards the end, mm-hmm. but do you want to just talk about the hardest things that you had to deal with?
Okay, so it's kind of like saying what were the highlights of that month, because it was 20 pretty much 20 days, so there were lots of little moments of difficulty and lots of moments of great, I guess, elation, and
I can imagine.
It varied. I have to think about this, but I haven't really been through all my photos because I remember taking. And I guess it's a bit traumatic to
You need some closure first.
Potentially, and maybe it's a good thing that I do, and it's probably a good thing that I'm speaking to you about this. This is the first real big conversation I've had about it. A big challenge was the climbing, and I thought that it would be easier, but the fact that everything else was quite difficult in terms of the weather, the road surfaces, the wind was probably the biggest factor. It was a headwind for me about 80% of the way.
Wow.
Across the, you know, and not just any headwind, it was demoralizing, absolutely awful headwinds.
Having to double your effort headwinds.
Yeah. And I had this, I had a power meter on me, which is, it records your power.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason I had that was because I wanted to know when something wasn't right. And that was a way I could tell. So if I felt fine and I was putting out the right amount of power, but I was going on a flat surface, I knew that there was probably a headwind or something, or if there was no wind, I was putting out the right amount of power or something like that, then I knew that I was going up a very slight uphill or something like that, where mm-hmm. a lot of the time you're quite delirious and you can't tell if you're going up or down sometimes. It's hard all the time.
Gosh, because you don't sleep much by the looks of things.
No, you don't. I think the longest sleep I've had, probably 5 hours, and that was in a hotel.
Wow.
So, not many people got any more than that. The people at the front probably averaged about 2 to 3 hours a night.
Oh, my goodness. I can't even imagine, to be honest with you, I have to say. And I saw, I think at the very beginning as you were going through, so it sounded like the first couple of days were brutal, as just probably a shock to the system, I would imagine, but the weather that was pouring down with rain and mm-hmm. and I think you had knee pain, if I'm not mistaken.
I did. So one of the things I didn't realize, and not many people who were close to me also knew, that if you keep doing these in really long distances, day after day after day, your hamstrings tend to shrink.
Okay.
So what happens is that you compensate by overextending your ankle
mm-hmm.
on the stroke. So you're putting more strain on. I'm not at all medically trained, and I don't have any. This is all anecdotal evidence.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is what I felt. Is that I was putting strain on my Achilles heel, and it was essentially kind of it became inflamed. So it was. I've never had an Achilles problem in my life.
Yeah.
Never. I've never pulled an Achilles, snapped my Achilles or anything. It was really scary because I thought that is what happened, and I wasn't sure how I would deal with it and how I would go on if it was really that serious. So that was quite sad at the time and demoralizing. I remember sitting on the side of the road trying to work out what to do. And
what did you do? Did you go and see a doctor, or did you just see what happened?
Where was I? I was in, I think I was in France still, and I think I put it on Instagram that's what the problem was.
Yeah, you did.
I'm just looking at it now. I took a picture of it, and I guess said that this is really bad, and maybe this is it. And I had all these messages and text messages and people offering suggestions of what I should do.
Mm-hmm.
And So I tried all these things, like massaging it, getting ice. I put it on ice. So I checked into a hotel that was only a few kilometers away, and I asked for a bag of ice, and I literally just rested up and massaged it, and followed a bunch of these suggestions that were the ones that were more unanimous, I guess.
Okay.
Because some of my friends were professionals, and they said, "Oh, if it looks like this or if it feels like this, it's probably this. So why don't you just try this?"
Okay.
So that's what I did, and I strapped it up the next day. So I went to a pharmacy and I bought some. They didn't have any sport specific strapping tape, but mm-hmm. Made do with what they had and made it as firm as possible, and it helped. It was still painful probably for the next 5 days, but it slowly died down, and I gradually just stopped noticing it because the pain of everything else. Distracted by the headwind and the heat and whatnot.
Yeah, because that's a lot of time to spend on a bike saddle apart from anything else. I can't imagine that's the most comfortable for that kind of that stretch of time over every day, but we won't go into that in too much depth. And then I guess were there points where you, apart from, because I know obviously the Achilles was really worrying, but and I saw that you went through some beautiful scenery. But I guess when you're and when you're riding at night as well, things can get quite monotonous, and that plays with your head a little bit. I would have thought in its own way. Yep. So I guess were there other points where you felt like you'd had enough and you wanted to quit? And how did you deal with the boredom as well, I suppose?
Okay, so there's a few things there. The fact about quitting, yes, there were loads of times that I not necessarily wanted to quit. I just wanted it to be over.
Okay, yeah.
And quitting to me wasn't an option. And it was good that I experienced this because... one, I didn't feel like quitting. Two, quitting seemed to be more mentally and logistically challenging than just keep, than if I just kept going.
It's almost like you don't have a choice, isn't it?
You don't really have a choice. You're not going to turn back.
Yeah.
So often, say I was in Bosnia or something, the nearest train station was probably, the main train station or airport that I can think of is either Dubrovnik or Zagreb or something like that, or Sarajevo, and I was in the middle of nowhere. And I don't want to have to go back. I hate going back. This is one of the things. I hate going back on myself.
Okay.
So if someone says, "Oh, I'm just going to go out and back," I'm like, "Oh, I don't want to do that. I'd rather do a loop because I want to go."
Okay.
I don't know what it is, but it's a weird thing about me. I felt that quitting was too much effort. And then what do you do when you get to an airport? You have to find a bike box and you have to take apart your bike, and then you have to pay all this money to get this last minute flight to wherever. And a lot of my friends came out to see me at the finish line, and they were waiting in Istanbul, so there was no way I was going to I couldn't go back to London for one thing. Mm-hmm. So I had to keep going to Istanbul. So I could have flown there, I could have taken a train there, but the train's hideously complicated. Expensive, probably, and the plane just felt I couldn't deal with having to deal with my bike and getting a bike box and then trying to get it on a flight, and then I just thought I'll just ride there.
Easiest, quickest way to get there. Although quickest, I'm not sure. Yeah, exactly.
It was the least cognitively.
But that's really interesting, because I guess you go into, to an extent, it's survival mode. You know, you're finding food, you're finding shelter, you're cycling.
Yeah.
And you're back to the fundamentals of life for a exactly. short period of time.
And I think you spoke about this with your last...
Yeah.
You don't really have to think about much besides food, shelter, and, you know, I guess water. But for me, I knew that I was comfortable with my roots, mm-hmm. so I didn't have to worry about that. And yeah, everything else was just, I'll just deal with it as it comes.
Yeah, you have to be quite flexible probably in your daily approach, because you don't really know what's going to happen.
No, and the worst thing is when it rains, that's really not a good thing to experience, because I never had accommodation booked in advance, really.
Mm-hmm.
Most you'd do is maybe, well, for me, I'd just call up a place when I was an hour away or something, and made sure that I could get a bed or something. But generally, when you're going for a ride or a run or something, as you know, if it starts raining, you just keep running. You don't really care, because you know you get up and have a shower on the other end, and you can go to bed or whatever. But when you're doing this event, you've got no idea where you're going to be, and you've got no idea how you're going to warm up and dry yourself off. So because if it keeps raining for days, you'll just be constantly wet, and you'll get cold, and you'll get sick, and all sorts of things like that, and you won't be able to sleep properly, and just be horrible. So that was a difficult thing to deal with, and it was a challenge, but it always kind of worked out that I found a hotel at 5 a.m. in the morning or something like that.
Wow, that's amazing.
That would open their doors and let me stay for 4 hours while I had a 2-hour nap and a shower and tried to dry my kit off.
Amazing. And what was it like dealing with, because I don't really know how you train for an event. Like, you can't really train to do this type of event. Obviously, I don't know, maybe you can tell us a bit more.
I tried to do some training while me and my girlfriend were touring. We after I quit my job, we decided to go touring around Europe. Bike touring, that is. So we started in Le Havre in France, and we went down the west coast down to San Sebastian. Then we cycled across the desert to Barcelona, and then we went along the coast all the way to Tuscany and to Florence.
Wow, so beautiful.
Yeah, so I thought that I would try and train while I was doing that, and that would involve maybe doing a short ride to get to our next destination, and then I'd go off and do another 100 or 200 kilometres on my own. It never really worked out like that. And I did a few big rides, but nothing that would be that suitable for this type of race. So mm-hmm. when we got to Girona, where I am now, we decided that I needed to do one really big ride to try and do something about this and get more attuned to the type of riding that I'm going to experience. So I said to my girlfriend, why don't you take do you want to take the train to Nice, and I'll meet you there, I'll ride and you take the train. And it seemed that the train was much more faff than just riding, because there were so many changes, and she had to take her bike on the trains, and some of the trains wouldn't let bikes on, so she had to take regional trains, and it was a lot more faff for her.
Right.
But yeah, she met me in Nice, and I cycled there. It was 620 kilometres.
Okay.
And that's the biggest ride I've ever done. And,
right.
And before the Transcontinental.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest before that was 350, I'd say, or 390 maybe.
Okay.
And I needed to just dive into it and just do something that I didn't put much thought into it. I just said, I'm just going to ride this and see what happens. So I need to test out my kit, test out my body, see what I'm sort of able to deal with. You have to... It does really help. That was the biggest help. It was kind of doing that ride.
from a psychological preparation perspective?
Everything.
Everything.
I just felt comfortable with knowing where to find water, knowing where to find shelter.
Okay.
And where to, what, you know, because in France, things open at weird times. Like, they have like a siesta sometimes, and in some parts of France, on Sundays they're closed, so you have to be aware of what's open and how to get food and how to get shelter or how to get what you need. And generally just where to sleep, because I was rough sleeping that whole time, and I think I only slept 1.5 hours that whole trip. Whole 620 km or whatever.
So how do you deal with that? Because when you're doing the actual race, you've got mental fatigue, you've got physical fatigue, and then you've got sleep deprivation.
And you've got emotional...
That seems like... Yeah, exactly. That seems like a cocktail for not very healthy emotional thoughts. So how do you overcome that and keep going? Because that's not easy.
I think it was really useful putting my experiences on social media, on Instagram.
Okay.
Because I got a lot of feedback and just support on that. People were saying, oh, keep going, you're doing awesome, and just so much support from friends and people who, even people who I hadn't spoken to in years. It was great to hear from
Amazing.
Them. And family and colleagues and people who were keeping an eye on me, which was really nice. And that really kept me going the most, I think. That was the biggest support.
Have any sort of mental tricks that you played apart from that? Because not everyone does, but some people have things like counting or, I don't know, focusing on the next lamppost when things are really tough and just getting there and then extending it.
No, I look at the numbers, really. I broke down the whole, because it's a really long way.
Yeah.
So I broke down my whole route into three big stages of about 1,100 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so I had, there's four checkpoints, right? But they're not equally spaced. Two of them are close together, and then the other two are closer together. So for me, I set my own milestones, and I knew that rather than do halfway, I knew that for me, doing it in thirds. So with two sort of checkpoints, once I reached my own sort of second checkpoint/milestone, I was already more than halfway there, right?
Okay, yeah.
So I'm on the home leg. I'm on the home straight.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're halfway, you think, oh, God, that's only halfway. And I've got another halfway to go.
That's quite a good tip, actually.
As long as I reached the second milestone, which was, two-thirds of the way in, then that really helped me mentally feel like, I've only got this much to go now, and I know what this is like. And then I would just... I broke these three milestones down into smaller stages as well. So I think I had maybe 11 individual sort of stages for me.
Okay.
So I treated it like a bit of a stage race, I guess.
Yeah.
And
then you just focus on that. Yeah, it just helps you break it down, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. To get to the next milestone. Because I never counted things, or I don't know. That's just how I dealt with it.
Because it sounded like the beginning was particularly tricky for the reasons we discussed earlier, but it also sounded like the end... and the last few days were pretty tough, were the hardest. I think you said in your post that they were the hardest.
Yeah, the cycling through Turkey was, just really demoralising. They don't go around mountains or hills. They just go straight over them.
Right.
And in big straight lines.
Okay.
So... they, rather than take the path of least resistance, which might be through it, as in a tunnel, or around it, maybe adding 10 or 10% to that trip, they'll just go straight over it. And so you're constantly going up and down and up and down and up and down. And the hardest thing is that the heat and the headwind just adds to that. And then when you're going downhill, you don't feel like you're going fast at all. You're rolling and not pedaling, but you're not getting anywhere faster.
Right.
So it's all a cocktail of, demoralization.
And presumably what was driving you then was just because you're in the last third.
Yeah.
Getting to the end.
Yeah. And then once I reached the last 600 kilometers, I knew what that was like.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'd done that big ride from Girona to Nice.
Yeah.
I thought, okay, well, that's it. I can do this now. I've done more than however many percent. I've just got to keep pedaling and make sure I'm not killed in a horrific accident.
I can imagine that there were lorries on some of the roads.
There were lorries on many of the roads, constantly, because you have to really take the main roads to get there quicker. Otherwise, you take forever trying to take the pretty routes. A lot of it's not the most scenic thing, but a lot of it is. A lot of it's stunning. So.
What were the highlights? Because the pictures looked amazing.
The people. I don't know if you read any of those. Some of the captions.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, sounded like you had some really nice interactions with, and generosity as well from people.
Yeah, just absolute generosity from. I think it's a pretty well known thing that. Often people in poorer countries are more willing to share what they have with you. And I don't know if you experienced this, but I had it loads, and it was more than I expected, and just completely out of the blue. You know, people were offering me, their bed for the night, or there was this one time I was riding almost at the Albanian border, and I was riding past this house on this country road, and these guys just saw me from about 200 meters away in their house, because there's nothing else going on, and they saw this this bright light sort of going past, and they were like, "Yay!" And they yelled out. And I stopped, and I didn't know what they were saying, and they waved me to come over. So I cycled up their driveway, their gravel driveway path, and we had a chat. None of us could speak the same language. And they were just gesticulating that I come drink with them and come stay with them and eat with them. And I said, "Oh, I'd love to, but I must keep going. I'm really sorry." And that's quite hard to say when you're. People don't really understand what you're doing and why you're in a hurry. There were times like that.
Amazing. Mm. And it must have been pretty interesting. I know it was over quite a short period of time, so I don't know whether you have the ability to absorb sort of culture in the way that people interact and things, but you did cross 11 countries, so you've got quite a broad spectrum of Europe, really.
That was what really drew me to do it in the first place. I didn't really want to do it because it was some kind of epic race, because I didn't really care about the competitive aspect of it. I just wanted to do it because it sounded really interesting. A friend told me about it, and I didn't know what it was, and I looked it up, and I thought, oh, that looks great. Get to go through all those countries. I'd never choose to cycle through that. Well, I never had thought about it before, but now I would definitely go back, to do that in a slower way.
Yeah.
That was the real draw. I really like exploring new places, so I just wanted to see what it was like and just check it out. And then it hit me that it was actually a big challenge and I should probably train for it. After the realization that I'd been accepted and that it was pretty cool that I was going through all these places, even if it was a flyby sort of tour. But I think I experienced enough to know that I wanted to go back.
Okay.
And like there were some spectacular places which I never thought would be, like Bosnia and Slovenia. I knew that was, I heard it was quite nice and I was looking forward to that. But Albania was spectacular. I had all these ideas beforehand and people were telling me that Albania was horrible, the drivers are dangerous and crazy, the roads are terrible, it's really dangerous, there's bandits, you'll get mugged and, don't stop, all this sort of stuff. And it was completely the opposite of everything that I had thought of.
Wow.
So the roads were really good, except when you went really kind of off-piste, I guess, off main roads. But in fact, I read afterwards that Albania actually export their asphalt to other parts of Europe because it's such good quality.
Wow, there you go.
Yeah, the people were really generous, really nice. The drivers were fine. Actually, I found the worst drivers were in Italy, out of all the places. Yeah.
How interesting. Well, they should be used to a lot of cyclists on the road, you'd have thought.
So, but maybe I don't know why. I wouldn't want to speculate.
Why
that might be. But it was the roads are terrible in Italy.
Right.
Friend tells me it's the whole traffic. The government is a bit of a banana republic, and none of the money that comes in through taxation actually goes to the right places, like roads and public services. So I guess that's part of the reason why they're in such a bad state. But the roads in Albania were a pleasure compared to Italy.
Yeah, but it's because what you said earlier, I was actually going to ask you why you did the race. Mm. You sort of, you answered it in the sense that it started off with this adventure exploration and then it was like, actually it's a physical challenge.
Yeah,
better get onto it. And how do people sign up for the race? What's the process to enter?
So there is an application process. Starts with registering your interest. It happens about November. So at the start of November, I think roughly, people are invited to register, and this. This kind of gives people time to cool down, I guess, because a lot of people just make, they just make these decisions, these impulse decisions.
Yeah.
Think, oh yeah, I'll do that, and then it gives them time to cool down once they realise how hard it is, because the organisers, Mike and Anna, they want to make sure that people really know what they're getting into.
Okay.
Really not. They don't want people dropping out.
And it's quite a small field, actually.
It is a small field because the race needs to be small enough that it's not a. There's no real impact on terms of local communities and on roads, and it doesn't disrupt things because they don't want it to be seen as something that people don't want, because they, maybe the Tour de France goes through towns and it causes a lot of disruption and blocks roads every year. So they don't want it there now. So it's the kind of thing where it needs to be big enough that it's exciting to watch because there's enough people doing it. But at the same time, you don't want riders coming into contact with each other all the time.
Yeah, okay.
Because it changes the dynamics of the race.
Mm.
Generally, when you see someone on the road, you might catch up to them, or someone stopped to have some food, and then you might stop at the same place or whatever, like something like that. It will change the type of race because people will tend to have conversations with each other, and that's fine. But you're not allowed to help each other. There's no slipstreaming allowed, which is generally a huge advantage in normal bike racing.
Yeah.
So it's a complete solo effort. Unless you're in the pairs category. So there is a pairs category, which I think I had about 10 pairs. And in that situation, then you can share food, share tools, that sort of thing. But in the solo category, which is most of the people, you're not allowed to share anything. So if you help someone who's got a puncture and they've got no spare tires or something like that,
that's
counted as outside help, essentially.
Okay.
And you will be not disqualified, but you'll be paired together. So you'll be now, if you help someone, you'll be a team.
You
might be considered in the solo category because you've given help and someone's accepted help.
I was just going to say, what did it feel like to finish after these 4,400 crazy kilometers?
It's hard to say. I remember coming in at about 3 a.m. and I was pretty tired and pretty hungry, but I wasn't spent completely. I could have kept going if I had to.
Oh, wow.
I think it was almost sad that it was over.
Mm-hmm.
As I was coming into Istanbul, most people who came during the day, anyone who's been to Istanbul will know that it's crazy on the roads. The traffic is pretty hectic. And fortunately, I came when it was really quiet. So I had a lot of time to just sit up and take it all in. As soon as I saw the Bosphorus, I started sort of riding really hard to get there as quick as possible. And then after about, I don't know, 10 minutes, I realized, actually, I should enjoy this. And
right. It
makes no difference to the time, really. Like, no one's...
Yeah.
I was coming quite far back in the field anyway, so it didn't really matter. I wasn't racing anyone.
Yeah.
There was no reason for me to get there quicker except just to make it finish as soon as possible. But it was... Yeah, I sat up and just tried to enjoy it, and then I realized that it's going to be over, and it was quite sad. And what am I going to do next? What am I going to do tomorrow? I didn't know. So
sort of feelings of elation.
I cried when I got there, but
okay.
It wasn't as emotional as when I reached the top of Mont Ventoux, which was the first checkpoint. But I didn't jump for joy or anything like that. You know, I'm sure if you speak to most people, they kind of just slump and go, "Oh God."
But I think, a phenomenal achievement to have ended. And I think I also saw on the website that there were probably very few women that started the race, but I think only one woman completed it.
Yeah, so originally 11 women were on the start list.
Okay, so of the 172.
So 11 were meant to start, but 7 started in the end. But due to various reasons, only one woman finished last year. And she was in a pair originally, her partner fell ill. And basically had to abandon the race, but she, Jane, her name was, decided to go on and finish the race on her own, which is great. And it was fantastic. So
amazing. I think in one of the previous podcasts we had one that definitely touched on the subject of gender balance in endurance running races, but this sounds like another one where...
Exactly.
Big question mark.
Exactly. There were not many women last year. I know there's a lot of reasons, and some of those it's a lot more intimidating for a woman to decide to cycle on her own in those sorts of conditions.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of women are comfortable with that, but a lot would feel more comfortable riding in a pair with another woman. usually for safety reasons, and that's completely understandable. Part of the so next year or this year, I'm actually involved in helping run the Transcontinental. So,
oh, fantastic!
Yeah, so part of that was to try and get more women involved this year because we want to see a more balanced field.
Brilliant.
And there are, I can't say how many, but there will be more women this year, which is great.
Okay, fantastic. Good work.
And hopefully, definitely more women finishers as well. So that's something to look forward to.
Brilliant. And I suppose, so you would recommend that people do it. Is there any particular piece of advice that you would give?
Ooh, any particular piece of advice? There's lots of various bits of advice, but I guess, yeah, you don't really know until you try it. Yeah, I think that all the advice I would have is very practical, stupid stuff, like brush your teeth twice a day because a lot of people are eating sugar, right?
Yeah.
So their energy levels up. What they don't realize is that the sugar feeds all the bacteria in their mouth, and when they eat more and more sugar, then that's when you get nasty stuff happening to your mouth. So a friend of mine, he got candida and kind of put him out for a while, but he had lots of yogurt, and he just ate lots of yogurt and swirled lots of yogurt in his mouth, and then eventually it kind of died down.
Okay.
But that's just one of the things. And then another, like, make sure you get a really comfortable saddle. And that's something I didn't do, and I suffered immensely from that.
Ouch.
Yeah, before the race, I had the option to put on the saddle that I like.
Mm-hmm.
But I had been touring on this other saddle, and I didn't really want to make any last-minute changes, even though I knew that saddle that I had from touring wasn't really that good.
Right, okay.
And I had the other saddle with me. I could have just put it on, and I decided not to make any last-minute changes because any sort of changes to the setup can be quite detrimental to your body. Because it can be a shock to the system when you're doing this intense sort of ride,
exactly.
And your body and your bike setup has changed.
Yeah.
So I decided not to do it, but I should have in hindsight, and just adapted. But it was probably the most painful thing in the whole trip.
Okay, I think that is a very, very useful piece of advice. If you're going on long cycle trips, get a good comfortable saddle.
Yeah.
I think that's been really, really fascinating. Thank you so much. I think you're a great example of somebody who sets very challenging objectives, both professionally and
Thanks.
With regards to sporting things, and just goes for them. And I just think that's awesome, and doesn't let the kind of fear that we all kind of experience in one way or another get in the way. So thank you so much for sharing all of that.
Thanks for letting me talk about it. I haven't really given it much thought since in this detail, so it's been nice to talk about it.
Great. And good luck for the move to Kenya.
Thank you.
That sounds really exciting as well. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Hi again. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed learning about Leo's story. And as I said at the beginning, he kind of makes me feel like anything is possible, which is pretty cool. As usual, his details and interesting links will be on the notes to this episode on the livebeyond.co website. The podcast is also available on iTunes and Audioboom if you want to go and find it there. So thanks again for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Bye.